I've mentioned it several times, and I've been approaching, you know, this last class with some hesitancy again, because I find it just so very, almost overpowering emotionally. There are only a couple of men in all of Scripture to whom so much Scripture is devoted. There are only a couple of men in all of the Bible about whom we know so much, about whose personal thoughts and sufferings and temptations are so well known, whose successes, which are many and impressive, but whose failures also, you know, are renowned and recorded for all these ages. And so here we find ourselves, as you look at our title slide, and what will be our 18th and final class on the book of Deuteronomy, and this is the immediate area that Moses is in. He's at the foot of these mountains, which are in modern-day Jordan. He's brought the Israelites through 40 years of the wilderness wanderings. He's 120 years old, and he'll never cross the Jordan, which is at our backs as you look at this particular photo. I didn't take this one. And you see the camels there, you know, and a little bit of the green again to recognize that it's not necessarily just because you're at shores of the Dead Sea, you know, constantly barren and just burnt seasonally. It's very great and wonderful grazing land for various forms of livestock. You've got fruit trees that grow down there in abundance. And so there's a great palace that's just a couple of miles from this location at essentially the very same elevation, right? You know, at the bottom of the earth that Herod the Great had a palace situated out there. There's some ruins that remain. Another place I haven't yet seen in Israel, I'd like to go see one of these days. But, you know, it's the winter residence for the kings. And so Moses is coming for the first time to this promised land. Now, all of those kings and their appreciation for this land lie ahead. But Moses is looking up at this mountain. You can see there that it's more like a ridgeline, not a real singular volcanic kind of a structure here. But if you look carefully there at the top where all the greenery is, that there are structures there, big visitor center and everything. And that's the highest point of Mount Nebo. Now, obviously, this photograph was taken from a boat or from the western shore. And again, I didn't snap this photo. But it's just a beautiful view then of where in a moment Moses will be standing. But at this moment, as we come to the tail end of Deuteronomy 32, he may quite actually have turned to look up at a view somewhat similar to this one. When it says in Deuteronomy 32, verse 48, Yahweh spoke to Moses that very same day. He's just taught them that song that we studied last week. And on that same day, God said to him, verse 49, go up to this mountain of the Abarim, Mount Nebo, which is in the land of Moab, opposite Jericho, and look at the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the sons of Israel for a possession. Then die on the mountain where you ascend. Be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother died on Mount Hor and was gathered to his people, because you broke faith with me in the midst of the sons of Israel at the waters of Meribah Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. And I'm sorry, I lost my place here. Because you did not treat me as holy in the midst of the sons of Israel. For you shall see the land at a distance, but you shall not go there into the land which I am giving the sons of Israel. And so this terrible moment has been repeated, you know, a handful of times now, where God keeps reminding Moses of his great failure. I suppose the last thing anybody wants to hear about when they know that the time of their departure is at hand is that they've been guilty of some terrible sin that's been haunting them for decades and will deprive them of what was the single greatest hope, I'm sure, the most powerful desire that Moses would have had in 120 years of living and serving his God. And so now you see, you know, for the umpteenth times, we brought it up so many times, how terrible this moment is. Moses, we always think of him as just triumphant. We think of him as a wonderful sufferer. The people gave him so much grief. It was just, you know, awful how he had to suffer through all those years. And so constantly fighting against him, resisting so many things that God had asked him to do. And then he failed. He apparently cracked. We talked about it before. He himself has upbraided these people for their sin and for their failure because it tempted him and he sinned too. So I mentioned a while ago, you know, I've been feeling more and more emotional. I know a lot of you have. I've seen a lot of tears in the last few weeks. And we're sharing, you know, this sense of impending departure. But one of the things that just brings me such joy, and I'm sure it does for you too, is that I don't look upon you as having failed. I don't think too many of you look upon me as having failed. We're not focusing on error and mistake, you know, and tragedy. And the deprivation, you know, of great hopes that are quashed, you know, because of failure at all. We've had, I think, just a great and wonderful relationship. Let me just say, I've had others that ended far worse. And so I have something of an idea of being glad to be out of there, you know, and just kind of disgusted with an awful lot of people. Now, I have seen great and terrible and notorious sins that I've had to deal with, both privately and publicly, but none of them here in the last 7 years at all. And so in this case, it's just providential that we were coming down to this material. But I confess that it just has filled my mind for weeks and weeks now with how glorious it is to have been a part of this congregation, how great you people are, just how very wonderful, you know, it's all been. And here we have this monument, you know, to knowing when your time of service and or leadership, at least, you know, of teaching, is coming to an end. In Moses' case, you know, now his life as well. So he broke faith, according to verse 51. According to verse 51 there at that place, he did not treat God as holy in the midst of the sons of Israel. There's some question, of course, about what exactly transpired. Nobody's going to be able to answer those questions, you know, until the judgment, if God chooses to reveal them even then. But it was just awful bad. And so with what has to be, I suppose, as much a just broken heart at his failure as the fear that when I climb this hill, I will die. I'm never coming off that hill. There it is. And from these plains of Moab, it just towers above. And yet, it's not very high. It's a couple of thousand feet. It's no big deal. It's like the hills around here. You know, it's not a big deal. You can get up there easily enough. And so, with all these emotions, now, the 33rd chapter is devoted to a blessing. Now, Moses has endured such resistance, you know, and problems throughout all of his life. But here is the blessing which Moses, verse 1, the man of God, blessed the sons of Israel before his death. Now, some of this won't sound much like a blessing, very little of it, and maybe we're just misunderstanding it or not understanding it, but it's described as a blessing. Each of the tribes are about to be mentioned. Moses has led these tribes, known these tribes for these last 40 years, had defended them, murdered a man, you know, and driven out into the wilderness himself for the previous 40 years because of his love for this people. And so he blesses them. He's criticized them enough. God's just told him, you know, again, reminded him, it was his failure, but it's provoked by them. And yet, here is this blessing. Now, I believe, it's my conviction, that this is an inspired blessing. That the blessing which he is delivering here is not just Moses' own idea. So the things that are said here, you know, read, they come across as prophetic. And while often parents look to the future and would hope and pray for various things and tell their children that they're looking for these good things, you know, to take place in their lives, as we look at these things, I suspect that it would be more than a natural man would know. And so whether or not that's the case, we cannot know. It doesn't say. It just says Moses offered this very lengthy blessing, 29 verses, in which every one of the tribes will be mentioned. You might grab a pencil or a pen. There'll be a number of times where I'm going to either define a word that appears very rarely in Scripture and needs a definition, and or identify a place, as I will in verse 2. So if you want to just, you know, have your pencil at the ready, it'll clarify a lot. You won't have to go searching off as I had to do, you know, to find out what these words mean. So here it begins. Here's what he says in verse 2. Yahweh came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir, S-E-I-R. There you would put in parenthesis Edom. That's the other word for Edom. So they're down the south of Israel. Esau comes to mind, you know, in red and all those things that you read about in Genesis. But Seir is Edom. The next line is, he shone forth from Mount Paran. Mount Paran is in the wilderness of Sinai, and it's just north of Sinai. So it just is a mountain, Mount Paran, north of Sinai is what I added in my Bible. In his right hand there was flashing lightning. But note the last two words. You know, it was for them. When God does these things, he did it for them. These are divine choices for divine purposes, to make a divine impression and therefore a divine motivation, that these people will respond to their God, who is the only God, and therefore like no other so-called God. So he said, Yahweh came from Sinai and dawned on them from Seir. He shone forth from Mount Paran, and he came from the midst of 10,000 holy ones. And his right hand there was flashing lightning for them. Indeed, he loves the people. All in this, of course, they use the word thy because it is, I think, appropriate to translate your in this case in that manner, so that we'll recognize the your is not Israel he's referring to, but God. So God's holy ones are in your hand, God's hand. And they followed in your steps. Everyone receives of your words. Moses charged us with a law, a possession for the assembly of Jacob. And he, was king in Jeshurun when the heads of the people were gathered, the tribes of Israel, together. So we have a prologue in this blessing. Jeshurun, which I believe has already been used once before in this book and very rarely elsewhere, Jeshurun means upright. And it is apparently a divine term of endearment for all of Israel. So Jeshurun, when you see it, is God's friendly and beloved representation of these people. It literally means upright. Or, of course, upright ones. So God was king in the upright, or of the upright, or for the upright, for Jeshurun. Verse 6, firstborn. May Reuben live and not die, nor his men be few. Well, Reuben's long dead, isn't he? Long, long dead. So who's the Reuben? What's he talking about, live and not die? He's already dead. The tribe. These are tribal hopes. These are tribal blessings. All of the Reubenites is what it means. Then in verse 7, and this regarding Judah. So he said, hear, O Lord, the voice of Judah. Bring him to his people. With his hands he contended for them. And may you be a help against his adversaries. So every one of the Reubenites has had an extremely short blessing. And now come the Judahites, you know, the tribe of Judah, and they have had their short blessing. Now he turns to Levi. Levi, of course, is the tribe from which all the priests come, and this one's not short. They have great responsibility. And so it's not surprising that he would say of Levi in verse 8, "Let your," that would be God's, "Thummim and your Urim belong to your godly man, whom you proved at Maasah, with whom you contended at the waters of Meribah." Now, this is one of those places really helpful to get some notes in there. There's two different words. They mean two different things. Maasah means to test. Test. Meribah means to strive. To test and to strive. The scriptural reference is Exodus chapter 17, verses 1 through 7, where they tested God, but God was also testing them. But they strove against God. The people failed, Moses failed. You know, it's a great and terrible disaster we've been discussing. So God contended with them at the waters of Meribah. But Maasah and Meribah are the same place. They're not two different places. They're two different names for the same place, very expressive of what was this great tragedy that took place there in Exodus 17, verses 1 through 7. So you can read that for yourself. Now in verse 9, who said, Levi said, of his father and his mother, "I did not consider them. He did not acknowledge his brothers, nor did he regard his own sons, for they observed your word and kept your covenant. You shall teach your ordinances to Jacob and your law to Israel. They shall put incense before you and whole burnt offerings on your altar. O Lord," that's O Yahweh, "bless his substance, accept the work of his hands, shatter the loins of those who rise up against him and those who hate him, so that they may not rise again." We've seen just last Sunday night in 2 Timothy 3, where it says, "All who live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution." I made the point at that time that that would be certainly and absolutely true in the time of the Great Tribulation, which Timothy was living in, and all the saints were living in at that time. But that expression should not be applied to just everybody universally in all of Christianity. Few of us have suffered at all for our Christianity. We've lived a wonderfully blessed time. Okay, but these people have, you know, terrible opposition and persecution. They're the Levites. And most men who are leaders among God's people face opposition. Brother, you know, we hate it. We wish it wasn't true. But it's necessary that there be the entire spectrum from very, very faithful to not very faithful at all that you find in every congregation, that you found among the Jews, that you found on earth before the flood. It's just always been the case. And those who are less interested in spiritual matters, those who are more selfish about how sure they know everything better than everybody else, those people make life miserable for the leaders. And so here's this prayer, and God's backing his leaders in this whole tribe of Levi. Now, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that if your loins get shattered so that you may not rise again, that's kind of tough. That doesn't sound very pleasant to me at all. And so there's a whole long statement in this great blessing, which is recorded in this book, which will be kept for these people, which is probably inscribed on those stones shortly later up there on the mountaintop. And so these people had the song, they had the inscription of the law, and they've got this blessing, which is also a great warning and a threat to anybody who decides that, they've got a better way than God's way and decides to rebel against these Levites. So they not rise again. All right, long blessing there, 8 through 11, and a warning. Now comes verse 12. Of Benjamin, he said, "May the beloved of Yahweh dwell in security by him, who shields him all the day, and he dwells between his shoulders." That is, Benjamin dwells between God's shoulders. That picture is kind of like sitting on, you know, shoulders the way a baby would his daddy going for a piggyback ride, I suppose. Benjamin, of course, was which of the 12 sons? Absolute youngest. Joseph, of course, in Israel, we read much about this in our Sunday night series on him. You know, had not known him and made his brothers go back and bring him, you know, and all of that. And so Benjamin was the youngest. Now here comes Joseph in 13. Of Joseph, he said, "Blessed of Yahweh is his land with the choice things of heaven, with the dew from the deep lying beneath, and with the choice yield of the sun, with the choice produce of the months, with the best things of the ancient mountains, with the choice things of the everlasting hills, with the choice things of the earth in its fullness, in the favor of him who dwelt in the bush." Who dwelt in the bush? God, when he called Moses, the burning bush. Okay, with the choice things of the earth and its fullness, the favor of him who dwelt in the bush, let it come to the head of Joseph, to the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. As the firstborn of his ox, majesty is his. As his horns are the horns of the wild ox, with them he shall push the peoples all at once to the ends of the earth. And those are the 10,000s of Ephraim. Those are the thousands of Manasseh, who, of course, are the sons of Joseph, the two sons of Joseph. So, here's an equally long blessing, very similar, maybe, you know, a line or two shorter than that for Levi, that's offered for Joseph. What very singular and wonderful thing did Joseph do for all the tribes? Just saved them off, you know, from the famine and brought them into, you know, Egypt. And as many years would go by, of course, that they're going to be thrust into slavery. They're going to be there for 430 years. And finally, Moses leads them out. As he is just concluding his 40th year of so doing. But Joseph had been providentially set to save them. And one of the last things you read in Genesis chapter 50, the last chapter of Genesis, "You meant it for evil," he tells his brothers, "but God meant it for good." So, you know, Joseph suffered terribly, but also saved everybody's lives. And so he hadn't been much appreciated by his brothers. You know, always knowing better, do it this way, do it that way, and it'll be so much better. But you know, and in his case, just shut up. We don't want to hear anything you've got to say. And, you know, and then all the lies that were told about him, Potiphar's wife, and then forgotten for years, you know, when he correctly prophesies, and it's in prison. You know, and so when he says in each one of these, naming that original son of Jacob that became the head of a tribe, he means, of course, these men are long dead, but may these tribes prosper. May these tribes succeed. And you know, picking out any one of these blessings, I'm kind of a selfish guy, I guess. I really like Joseph's. You know, Don and I are house hunting right now. Sure would be nice, you know, when we get up north right there, choice things of heaven with the dew, the deep that lies beneath, choice yield of the sun, produce of the months, best things of the mountains and hills, choice things of the earth is fullness, favor of God, you know, push all my enemies, you know, to the ends of the earth, give me some of that. You know? And so, I don't know, and the question would, you know, often arise, brethren, you know, families do tend to be similar. Families are associating. Tribes are in a given land. They're spending a lot of time together. Okay? They have family histories. They share family events. But they take on family traits as well. Were you to know my sons, probably every so often you would say, "Oh, that's just so like that nutcase that is their father." I can see so much of your dad in you. How many times do we hear that kind of expression? So again, we don't know how the various tribes are doing in relation to each other at this moment in time. But this tribe of Joseph sure gets blessed, doesn't it? And it makes you wonder if they aren't really standing out as a faithful group of people at this time. And it's not just a carryover from Joseph the man himself. It's not that, they've necessarily earned so much better than anybody else. I can't read that anywhere, you know, that they deserve it. So we're left just wondering. Well, wow, you know, this tribe, they're really getting the absolute best of everything. Okay, so now we come to Zebulun in verse 18. And of Zebulun, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going forth, and Issachar in your tents." Well, brethren, just like I was just saying, with Levi, I can understand a very long, you know, discussion. They're the priests. With Joseph, well, he saved everybody. You know, I appreciate that. But what does it mean, his long blessing? Well, look at this. Zebulun and Issachar don't even get their own blessings. They get lumped together. Well, why? And that is an absolutely cosmic unanswerability. You can't know. I have no idea. The scripture never says. So I don't know. It's noteworthy. Is it some kind of insult? Is it a failure that they're, you know, involved in right now? Is it just meaningless? Is it really important or not? I don't know. There's so many of these, brethren, I wish in Scripture, to know, and we're just denied. It's one of those secret things we saw in chapter 29 at verse 29. So Zebulun, he said, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going forth, and Issachar, in your tents. They shall call peoples to the mountain, for they shall offer righteous sacrifices. They shall draw out the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the sand." Well, now you see why I say, I think this has to be inspired blessings. How can Moses know the future that well? He's really turned now very pointedly from a kind of hopeful, may these things be, or at least what words could be understood that way, to a foretelling of the future. And that, in verse 19, two things. They shall call peoples to the mountain. Oh, they shall? Well, big deal. Now, Bill Kohler over there, he's called me up to the top of Pisgah several times. Let's go over there. I've had the dolls up on Spencer Butte while we were working out for this upcoming Israel trip. You know, so what? Unless what mountain in the future will this be? Zion in Jerusalem. That mountain. God has been speaking about a mountain that he will select. A mountain that eventually he will designate for these people in due time, but not very long from now. A mountain upon which they will have a temple built in the goodly distant future, and a 400 years future ahead. And so that just looks like, you know, this goes beyond the hope of a father for his children, or the request of a dying father to God for his children. That just looks like straight up prophecy. And the second part of verse 19, they shall offer righteous sacrifices. Well, how can Moses know that? He's informed of this. And so they'll do this. And then they'll draw out the abundance of the seas and the hidden treasures of the land. So that's sand, rather. You know, so that's great. They're going to get some physical blessings, like the others have been given physical blessings. But that's real spiritual stuff there in the first half of 19. They call the people to this holy mountain of God, and they offer righteous sacrifices there. So now, brethren, after I've laid claim to Joseph's blessing, give me that one. Okay? In verse 19, what would maybe a much wiser man request? Yeah, let me be the righteous one that calls people to worship. Let me be the one that offers the righteous sacrifices to God. Let me be that guy. So, you know, I went carnal. Okay? But that's a spiritual thing, isn't it? Jimmy?
I was looking back in Genesis of Zebulun.
Jimmy, I speak a little bit louder. I can't hear you.
Zebulun shall dwell at the haven or beach of the sea, and he shall go, he shall be for a haven of ships, and his boundary will come to Zion. And Issachar is a strong and it's between two burdens. I don't understand that one exactly, but going in and out, maybe that safe journey for him on his shipping.
Agreed. And, of course, she's now referencing, and I forget the chapter toward the end of Genesis. What chapter is it?
49.
So the next to last chapter of Genesis. Who's offering blessings there? It's Joseph about to die. Okay? So that's how Genesis ends. And what do we have at the end of Deuteronomy? A very similar thing. Tribe by tribe, blessings being offered. A long distance between them, but nonetheless, very similar form.
Is this also maybe prophetic in the fact that it seems like Moses knows what lands each tribe is going to be getting? In other words, that their blessing shows that this is the area they're going to be getting, even though he doesn't know?
Yeah, that's a great point. And again, I don't know how to answer that. Tribal lands are going to be designated, you know, long after Moses is gone. How much he knows about it, I'm not sure. But God often makes people privy to things, you know, that others don't know and are not recorded. So I can't answer that one. Okay, so we're up through verse 19 in this wonderful 29-verse blessing here in chapter 33. And we come to 20 then. Of Gad, he said, blessed is the one who enlarges Gad. Now, that just means who praises, who helps, who is beneficial to, you know, after Gad associates with them, Gad's better off for the association. Blessed is the one who enlarges Gad. He lies down as a lion and tears the arm, also the crown of the head. Then he provided the first for himself, and there the ruler's portion was served, and he came with the leaders of the people. He executed the justice of Yahweh and his ordinances with Israel. And there's one of those passages. Here's a blessing in verses 20 and 21. I don't have a clue what that means. And so again, I think a prophetic thing, and yet there is a reference that I can't identify in Scripture. And this very interesting and somewhat kind of ghastly illustration, like a lion that tears the arm, you know, whatever it is he's killed, he tears the arm and the crown of the head of the thing he's killed, and then he keeps the arm for himself. There the ruler's portion was reserved, and he came with the leaders of the people. I don't get it. So one of these days, maybe we will. But this, again, I think is one of those secret things that belongs to God, but also belongs to these people. My suspicion is they either understood this then or will understand it later and say, here's the fulfillment, you know, of this prophecy, or here's what at least it's talking about. But for you and for me, I think it's just denied. So I can't help you there. I don't know what's going on with Gad. Of Dan, in 22, he said, Dan is a lion's whelp that leaps forth from Bashan. Well, good luck with that one. What is that about? You know, Bashan is our Golan Heights of today. Okay. A lion's whelp is a baby lion or a young lion. So Dan is a lion's baby that leaps forth from Bashan. Well, good to know. You know how to interpret it, whether or not that's even an insult or a blessing, you know, I'm kind of not sure. And so I wish I knew. I don't. I think the people either did or would find out in good time. What you got there?
First Chronicles 12 and verse 8. Read, some Gadites joined David at the stronghold in the wilderness, mighty men of valor, men trained for battle, who could handle shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and were as swift as gazelles on the mountain.
Okay. All right. What? Everybody, listen carefully. Maybe write it down. What's the passage?
1 Chronicles 12 and verse 8.
1 Chronicles 12 and verse 8 speaks of Dan again like this lion. Okay? And then said, though, in the wilderness, right? Okay? Which is not Bashan. And so there's our problem. Bashan is not the wilderness. The wilderness of Judea is the wilderness. Bashan is the Golan Heights and not the wilderness. So I see the parallels there, and they're helpful. You know, get the verse. But then again, you'll have to work the problem. Call me as soon as I get back to Washington. Let me know, you know, how that all plays out, because I'm still confused. Okay, Bill.
There was a group from the tribe of Dan that apparently left wherever their territory was. Wherever their territory was, and took over that little territory way up in the north.
Correct. They had two different areas. And as I understand it, I'm quite sure, neither one of them's in Bashan. Okay, see, so that's what I said. Something happened in Bashan, or will happen in Bashan, or, you know, they helped another tribe with a military battle or something. I'm not saying it's not there to be found in Scripture. I'm just saying tonight I can't tell you, you know, what it is. But again, you're right. Dan got split. The great expression from Dan to Beersheba came into play because they went ahead and captured the land in the very far north. One of my favorite places in Israel, and everybody's, one of the most beautiful. Dan is immediately short walk, you know, away from what we know in the New Testament as Caesarea Philippi. That's where they were. You know, when you tour Israel, you see both sites. But, you know, there you go. I mean, that's why we toy with all these ends of clues, and then I can't reach a conclusion. Okay, so now we come to Naphtali. In 23 of Naphtali, he said, "Oh, Naphtali, satisfied with favor, full of the blessing of Yahweh, take possession of the sea and the south." Now, again, that sounds very prophetic to me. That sounds like something outside Moses' own abilities. This is some prophecy of great success in the south and along the shore. Now then, we've got Asher in 24 and 25. And this one really troubles me. Of Asher, he said, "More blessed than sons is Asher. May he be favored by his brothers, and may he dip his foot in oil. Your locks shall be iron and bronze, and according to your days, so shall your leisurely walk be." Well, that all sounds good. Sounds very promising. You know, lots of oil and massage the foot and all, you know. But why in the world is it a good thing for your hair to be iron and bronze? You know, I don't know where to go to try to understand why in the midst of the blessings of Asher, his hair is going to be iron and bronze. Is it, yeah, go ahead.
Is that locks the hair, or is the locks that are locked on your lock boxes in your houses?
Okay, and again, that was the next thing that was going to come out of my mouth. Or are we talking about being able to restrain people or things, you know, in safety? Maybe so. But which is it? And again, I don't know. So you lay both on the table. Good for you. You came up with the other one even before I could spit it out, you know, but what is it? I don't know. All right, so let's finish up. In 26, there's none like the God of Jeshurun. What does Jeshurun mean? Upright. This is that term of endearment again. Begins with it, he ends with it. There's none like the God of Jeshurun, who rides the heavens to your help, through the skies in his majesty. The eternal God is a dwelling place, and underneath are the everlasting arms. And he drove out the enemy from before you and said, "Destroy." So Israel dwells in security, the fountain of Jacob secluded in a land of grain and new wine. His heavens also drop down dew. Blessed are you, O Israel. Who is like you, a people saved by Yahweh? Who is the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty? So your enemies shall cringe before you, and you shall tread upon their high places. So it's a great blessing. It's good news for everybody. And Moses, now having finished this blessing, is telling them, you will have all your enemies cringing before you, and you'll tread on their high places. But just a day or two before, what was he telling them? And you're going to fail miserably and be destroyed is what you're going to do. So, brethren, is one true and the other false? No. And happily, it's just true. It's as easy for a Jew to be faithful in the land flowing with milk and honey as it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. It's just tough to be wealthy and be faithful. And this is why we, all of us, have such fear for the United States of America. It's just bad. And we're watching it right now. You know, we're amazingly wealthy, phenomenally so. Yeah, we have been ever since, you know, virtually we've been a country. And we're watching how every church there is, not just us, but all the others. Everybody's just dwindling away all over the country. Very rare to find a church of any kind that's growing, which is not some one of these mega church deals, you know, those flash in the pan fads that show up, what we call personality cults, led by some guy, you know, for a few years until he gets caught in a scandal or decides to take his money and run or what. But this, you know, on the whole, it, you know, is it a blessing or a curse to live in America? Well, for the faithful few, we get to enjoy both the physical and the spiritual blessings, each of which have been mentioned in this list of blessings. But it's difficult, very difficult, to be faithful when you're wealthy, and we're just the wealthiest nation on earth. Fear for yourself, fear for your neighbors, dig in, get busy. So then, chapter 34. In 34:1, now, Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Pisgah. Another name. It's like Sinai. It was also Horeb. This is Pisgah and Nebo, which is opposite Jericho. And Yahweh showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan. Now, if you'll direct your attention once more to the screen. This is the road that takes you up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo's top. So this is, you know, I don't know if it's halfway up or how far it is, but this is a very winding road. And again, see how green it is at this particular photograph at that time of year. But here are all the plains of Moab, and most of you probably won't be able to pick it out right here next to it. But right here is the shoreline of the Dead Sea. So you can see a little bit of blue right there, and see more blue right in through here. That is the north end of the Dead Sea. So this is a view. If I was Moses climbing this mountain, would I be in a hurry? I'm thinking I'd stop to smell the roses a time or two. How about you? I suppose a time or two he would stop and have a view, something like that, on the way up this mountain. And down below were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people. 40 years. He'd known some of them longer, a few. The Jordan lies in the distance. Soon they will cross. These hills, all of which you see right through here, this is the great ridgeline that is the center spine of Israel. So that from Mount Nebo, you cannot look all the way to the west and see the Mediterranean Sea, because this ridgeline, this central ridgeline, blocks the view. But today, because of 3 church spires that have been built, big observation towers, along this ridgeline, all 3 on the Mount of Olives there in Mount Scopus, but you know, just there immediately adjacent to Jerusalem. From Nebo, you can look across on a clear day and you can see those towers and you know exactly where Jerusalem is. As you continue to climb, you come now to the peak, and here now, again, you can see a lot more. All of this is the blue that is the Dead Sea. So now you're looking out across the plains of Moab. And then, I've shown you this map once before. And again, I realize unless you're sitting closer, you probably won't be able to get a whole lot out of this. But I cropped it and tried to make it as big as I could. I just love this map. It's the lines of unimpeded vision from Mount Nebo. So here's Mount Nebo. Now here are the lines that have been drawn. And now here's your central ridgeline right here, Mount of Olives. So you just saw the view. You saw the north end here, and you saw this. It just mentioned Jericho is, you know, right there, about 14 miles, I think, something like that. And so, you know, you could see the entire Dead Sea, which at that time stretched all the way down like this. Now it's broken. It's been drying up for the longest time. They're real worried about it and trying to figure out ways maybe even to pump water from the Mediterranean over here. They got a big project they're working on, but they're not installing it, but they're talking about it. And so when you look south, you know, that's one thing. When you look north, you see effectively just all of Israel. Here this line goes right through the vertical middle of the Sea of Galilee. You can see half the Sea of Galilee from there. And then again, you've got Upper Galilee, so you've got mountains that get in the way. And here's Dan at the very top. That's what is built, I think it was, pointed out. You can't see all the way up to what is Caesarea Philippi in the first century, but look at the vastness of Israel that you can see. Now, I'm suspecting that there was no smog. I'm also suspecting there had been no dust storms on this day, for which Israel's very notorious, and I thought I was going to die one day in one of them. And then, no fog either. I'm suspecting maybe even a miraculous vision, as it's a fair distance to see all these things, about 150 miles, from Dan to Beersheba. But Moses saw it all, apparently. Read verse 1 again. Moses went up from the plains of Moab to Mount Nebo, to the top of Nebo, which is opposite Jericho. The Lord showed him all the land, Gilead as far as Dan, and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah as far as the western sea, and the Negev, and the plain and the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees, as far as Zoar. So let me go on back here. Here's the Zoar down at the very bottom, you know, of the Dead Sea, or at least it's got a question mark somewhere in that vicinity. We're told he can see it. So when you go up on the top of Nebo today, Don and I were there in 2010, there's this marble slab direction thing that stands up there. So here you can see the plains of Moab in the distance, you know, behind it. But if you look at this, you know, if you look off this way, Hebron is over there. The Herodium, which would be built by Herod the Great, one of his marvelous palaces, and where his tomb was, it's only very recently been discovered. I can't wait to spend some time there this time, because I've been reading about its discovery since the last time I was there, and I'm very anxious to see Herod's tomb. But Bethlehem is over there. Qumran is here. Jerusalem is right out there. Ramallah, Jericho, Nablus, and which is the mountains of Ebal and Gerizim we've been talking so much about. Lake Tiberias, we know it as the
Sea of Galilee,
its biggest city being Tiberias, so it's had a number of names. This is all in kilometers, but Tiberias is the farthest away, 106 kilometers. What's that in miles?
About 63.
Yeah, it's about 63 miles. A kilometer, 6/10 of a mile. Now, forget Nablus, but take Jericho, 27. So that's 14 or 15 miles. You got to Jerusalem here at 46 kilometers. So it's about 30 miles, a little less than 30 miles. Qumran, Bethlehem, Herodium, Hebron. You know, in other words, even with the unaided naked eye today, you can see some of these things. When Don and I were there, we could see the spires in Jerusalem. So on a clear day, this particular photo taken in 2005, you begin to see, you know, a little bit more clarity, I hope. You know, but certainly they zoomed in some to see how much of the Dead Sea is available there. But it was probably more like this when Moses was there. So here's a photograph, and I forget now if this is late 1800s or early 1900s, but here's the view. You know, of the mountaintop. Was anybody building anything up there? Were they selling lemonade to tourists? You know, no. Was there a big marble slab to tell you how far it was in kilometers to all these places? Yeah, nothing like that. And here's the shoreline right there. All of that is the Dead Sea. So here's a Muslim rifleman, as you can see up there, sometime well over 100 years ago. With those visions in mind, we'll close Deuteronomy 34 with verse 4. Then the Lord said to him, "This is the land which I swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I will give it to your descendants. I've let you see it with your eyes, but you shall not go over there." So Moses, the servant of Yahweh, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of Yahweh. And he, that has got to mean God, buried him in the valley in the land of Moab opposite Beth Peor. But indeed, no man knows his burial place to this day either. Didn't know it then. Don't know it now. The burial location of Moab, of Moses in the plains of Moab, is unknown. Apparently, personally, buried by God himself. In verse 7, although Moses was 120 years old when he died, his eye was not dim, nor his vigor abated. Earlier we had read, you know, he had said, I can no longer go out or come in, just a few chapters back. Here we are told his vigor is not abated. So he had aged, and he had, you know, the effects of age upon him. I think the point is that he can't go out, go in. Well, he just made this whole hike up Mount Pisgah, you know, he's good enough for that. But still he is 120 years old. God, like he had miraculously preserved, you know, the people's sandals, for instance, you know, in the wilderness wanderings, has apparently preserved for Moses the view of the land. So can't quite tell. It's not particularly clear, you know, in the text there. My suspicion is that Moses saw more from that mountain than any other man ever has. Perhaps in vision, certainly with this vision that would be most unusual at 120 years, you know, of age. He viewed the land. He died. He was buried by God somewhere in those plains of Moab. And in verse 8, the sons of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses came to an end. Now Joshua, well, let me stop there for just a second. This is just, you know, my own personal opinion. But brethren, you know, this is the same 30 days that was spoken of about Aaron. And it appears to me that we might take a lesson from this. That it was not just coincidence, you know, they made it up on their own. But my thought is that there's really a lesson to be learned here. There's an appropriate time for mourning. And it appears to be 30 days. Now, today we all say, you know, you never get over a loss, and that's certainly true. It's also true, you read in these various books, and I've read several as I do counseling, you know, for loss. And, you know, on death and dying, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, had her stages of dying and all the rest of that. I read that 30 years ago. Okay, so they'll tell you in those books, every special day for the whole first year is just devastating when you've lost somebody. First time they're not there for their birthday, for your birthday, for the kids' birthdays, for the grandkids' birthdays, for Christmas, Easter, and New Year's, you know. Everyone is devastating. So I'm not trying to say you got 30 days to get over it. But there's this 30 days of national mourning. And then it's time to get up and get back, you know, to business. You must not let loss cripple you, no matter how great the loss. You may have the greatest, you know, marriage and love that ever the world's seen. Okay. But when you lose one or the other, you can't just be wasted away for the rest of your life. There's an appropriate time of mourning. And now it's time to get up and get busy again. So in 8, the sons of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. Then the days of weeping and mourning for Moses came to an end. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, was filled with the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. Isn't that a fun thought? We had a whole, 9 or 10 lessons on spiritual gifts here a year ago. We talked a lot about laying on of hands and how it figures in the New Testament. But here's a laying on of hands in the Old Testament and the spirit of wisdom for Joshua. Sons of Israel listened to him and did as Yahweh had commanded Moses. Since then, no prophet has risen in Israel like Moses, whom Yahweh knew face to face. for all the signs and wonders which Yahweh sent him to perform in the land of Egypt against Pharaoh, all his servants, and all his land, and for all the mighty power, for all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. Isn't it a marvelous ending to that book? A marvelous ending to a life of enormous hardship, of constant criticism, whining and moaning and murmuring and complaining. And the man just, you know, caved a time or two, but he got back up on his feet and did what had to be done. Go thou and do likewise. Class dismissed.